You're listening to the Sketchnote Army Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Rohde, the author of the Sketchnote Handbook and the Sketchnote Workbook, and this is the podcast where I chat with sketchnoters and visual thinkers and try to understand what makes them tick. Hey everyone, it's 2021 and this is the year to upgrade your sketchnote lettering with my Sketchnote Lettering Live Workshop Replay. In this two-hour recorded video replay, I teach my signature lettering style by showing you how I create letters, I share my tips and tricks, and my lettering philosophy. You can see me demonstrate two-line lettering, three-line lettering, condensed lettering, extended lettering, ligatures, scripts, and faux scripts, and handwriting. This two-hour recording includes a Q&A session where I answered student questions. And of course, you'll receive PDF reference sheets and practice sheets you can print and use to follow along. I'd love to help you build your lettering confidence. Purchase this workshop video recording today for only $15 at rohdesign.com/workshops/lettering. Hey, this is Mike Rohde, and I'm excited to kick off Season 9 of the Sketchnote Army Podcast with an interview with Leela Fever. He's the co-founder of Common Craft. They're the group that pioneered explainer videos, and he's an author of two great books. In this episode, Lee and I talk about the process they follow at Common Craft, sharing not only their philosophy, but tips and tricks as well, so you can apply it to your own process. We also discuss Lee's two books, The Art of Explanation and his latest book, Big Enough, with a discussion about constraints fueling creativity and building a business to suit your life rather than the other way around. You're going to love this episode. Everyone, it's Mike Rohde here, and I'm with Leela Fever. Lee, welcome to the show. It's so great to have you.
It's great to be here, Mike.
So Lee is the purveyor. Is that a word, purveyor? he's the creator of Common Craft explainer videos. I don't know if you have remembered several years ago, Lee was behind these explanation type videos around technology. But I think I'm going to stop trying to explain what you do and where you came from and let you do it. So Lee, who are you? What did you do? And then go right into your origin story, how you got to where you are.
All right. Wow. That's a big chunk of information there. I'll try to be as succinct as possible. My name is Leela Fever, and I'm the co-founder of Common Craft. And I'm also an author, I guess I should say too. But I think it's best just to go straight to the origin story, which will kind of reveal my background. So, I started off being an online community manager at a company in 1999 and got really excited about online communities and social media. It started Common Craft as a consulting company in 2003 to work with companies to implement early blogs, mainly discussion boards, online community, things like that, and really started to see that the problem that people were having with these new tools wasn't necessarily the features and things like that. It was like just a really kind of broad understanding of why these things matter, why social media matters. And I thought that as a consultant, it would be good for me if I could explain things to them better, if I could help my clients understand these things from a new perspective and kind of build a new mental model. And so I wrote some blog posts and got excited about the idea of this clear communication around technology. That sort of manifested in 2007 in my wife, Sachi, and I creating videos that were under the name In Plain English. So the first video was called RSS In Plain English, and the next one was called Wikis In Plain English. And they were videos that were stop motion videos. So it was pieces of paper on a whiteboard along with hands and markers. There were no faces. It was just a camera pointed down onto a whiteboard. And we did it on a lark. We thought maybe it would build a little attention for Common Craft, but had no expectations. But those videos went viral. And, you know, at the time we were excited because it made the first front page of dig.com. This was 2007. So I say it's the 2007 version of going viral. And suddenly our world changed. We were known as video producers. And those videos are now known as the first explainer videos of the YouTube era. And it really changed everything in our lives. We went from being consultants to suddenly we're known for being explainers and educators and communicators and visual thinkers and all these new things for us. And that opportunity has been the driving force behind everything we've done since then. That's, you know, 13 years ago. And we're still making explainer videos. We're now we license our visuals as well. And it was a good change for us and took us in a lot of new directions. And we've learned a ton. But that's still what we do. I'm still the sort of creative director at Common Craft. And I write all the scripts and do all the visuals for the videos.
Wow. That's a great story. And I remember those days. I think the one that caught my eye was, I can't remember if it was RSS. I think it was actually Twitter in plain English. Mm-hmm. Because it was right around the time that Twitter was released. And honestly, when I first started using it, I was like, "What? Why would I do this?" But then I started to play with it. And there was like the light bulb went on. Okay, now I see why this is valuable. But then I had all these other friends that I had to convince, like I was excited about it. And it was really hard to explain why it was valuable. And I think I remember sharing that video quite a bit in the day with all these people. Yeah. It's hard for me to explain to you why it's valuable. So go watch this video. And that was really helpful, right? I imagine that's a very similar experience for other people who encountered these videos as well.
Yeah, I think it was. There's a couple of stories there that might be interesting to the audience. RSS, which, you know, is still very alive and well today. In fact, this podcast is going out to people via RSS. But in 2007, blogging was huge. Everybody had a blog and everybody wanted more people reading their blogs. And they wanted people to subscribe via RSS. Mm-hmm. But the problem that bloggers had was it was hard for them to help people understand how to do RSS. And it was this new thing. And when we put our video RSS in plain English on YouTube, which was also fairly new at the time, suddenly they could embed a video for free right on their blog that told people about RSS. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the really big reasons that video did well, was that bloggers were able to adopt it for free and use it immediately. And it kind of was an early version of YouTube embedding that worked really well. The second story with the Twitter video, which was kind of interesting, you know, it was an original video. Twitter didn't hire us to make it. We were just fascinated with Twitter and thought that it had an explanation problem. And so we started working on the video. And as it was coming together, I emailed Biz Stone. Like, I didn't know Biz, and I just kind of out of the blue just emailed him and said, "Hey, we're working on this video. I'll send you a rough cut of it." And he loved it. And within a couple of weeks, we had sort of a handshake deal where no money changed hands. All I asked was that if they shared the video on Twitter.com, that it had a link to Common Craft. Mm-hmm. And that's what happened. So for about a year, there was a button on Twitter.com that said, "Watch a video." And when you clicked it, a pop-up popped up. And it was our Twitter in plain English video with a link that said, "Thanks to our friends at Common Craft." And that was probably one of the things that changed our trajectory, was getting that link in front of millions and millions of people in the early days of Twitter.
Wow. That's you can't ask for more than that, right?
I think the lesson that I hope is embedded in that is that I think that for people in sketchnoters and people who are looking for opportunities, that if you have some time to be able to try to solve problems for organizations that you feel like could be doing something better, whatever that is, and contacting them, reaching out to them and say, "Hey, look, I hope I'm solving this problem. If so, let me know and I can do more of it." I think that that's one way to look at it.
Yeah, I think that's a really good way to look at it for sketchnoters. We have sort of a unique ability to capture and analyze information, a lot like what an explainer video does, just more in two dimensions. And I know there's more and more sketchnoters are getting into either animation. Some of the tools that exist on the iPad allow you to record new drawing, right? So that could be considered a form of animation, and doing video work, whether it's training or other things. So I think there may be a shift about to happen where, you know, things become more animated potentially. So and it's a good reminder too. I've been a big believer in partnerships, finding partners, whether they're paid or just friends, has really benefited me. So I think looking at it from a partnership perspective, like your creative solution was, you don't have to pay us, just put a link to us. And it probably led to opportunities, right? That you couldn't imagine at the time, but became valuable as you made it available. So that's a really good lesson from that perspective. So you're still doing Common Craft teaching, you know, these teaching videos. So has it shifted to where you're doing discussions or doing these explainers for companies specifically, almost like a hired basis, a contract basis? Is that sort of the bulk of the work you do? Like, how does Common Craft operate these days?
Yeah. We do some custom work. But for the past, you know, since 2012, really, our business has really been based on Common Craft membership.
Okay.
And in that case, we make original videos, so videos that are our property, and we make them, you know, our focus lately has been videos that teach technology, but really more on the side of how, you know, what we say is safe, productive use of technology and the internet. So we try to are teaching people how to do research on the internet, how to have a good password, you know, how to avoid phishing scams, you know, things that are really practical lessons that mainly our members use in teaching others. So it's technology teachers, librarians, school districts, universities, sometimes companies, anyone who needs to explain something complicated involving technology might find a video in our library that can do it in about 3 minutes and hopefully saves them time. So that's really been the thrust of our creative work, is building that library. So we publish, you know, between 8 and 12 videos a year, new videos a year, and we're always building our library. And that's the sort of the bulk of our creative work, is doing that.
So it really goes back to the same, you know, the Twitter video that I discovered, or an RSS video explaining in a concise way how something works, or maybe a way to use it most effectively, is still the really the core of what you're doing.
It is. It is. And we still continue to believe that there's a lot of need there. You know, people ask, you know, oh, you're making these videos. Can't you find videos like that on YouTube or Khan Academy? And there are certainly a lot of amazing explainers on in both of those cases. Lynda.com is another one, which is now, I guess, LinkedIn Learning. But the thing that we say that we do differently is that, sure, it's easy to find things that teach you how to do something, how to create something, how to a tutorial of accomplishing a task. And there's some of that in our library, but we really work to operate at a much higher level in terms of the big picture and context, and answering questions that are not so much how, but why. Like, why should I care about this? Why does this matter? And I like to think that those things work in concert, where once someone can see why something matters, like you said that the Twitter in plain English video was something that helped you see why it mattered, then you're more motivated to maybe learn the details and do a tutorial that shows you exactly what to do. You know, most of the content in our videos is not coming from some amazing research. Most of it you can find in the first few paragraphs of Wikipedia or in a Wikipedia entry. What we do is repackage that information into a form that makes it more interesting and entertaining and maybe surprising in terms of how we communicate it.
It almost seems like I can imagine that the reason people subscribe to the work that you guys do is because they trust your vision. They know your approach, right? You're going to think about not just the tactics, but the strategy behind why technology can be useful. Because that, I think if I look back again at the Twitter thing, it wasn't so much that, you know, anybody can go into the Twitter and like make an account and type something and post it. Why am I posting it? What's the value of it? Who am I trying to reach with it? Like, it all came back to philosophical, like, strategy questions. And if you don't think about the strategy, you could waste a ton of time doing awesome, you know, Twitter posts, but not really, you know, in that context. And I would think that people who subscribe sort of trust you with a vision. Like, you could go to YouTube and find explainers, but man, I've certainly found solutions to problems on YouTube, but many cases I've had to dig a lot. The work that's been shared is really uneven. Like, sometimes it's good, and sometimes I'm like scrubbing through a 25-minute video that should have been five. Like there's some real value in like compression and intention. And it brings me back to something you mentioned that I also believe in, and that was you said something about, I write all the scripts as the creative director. So tell me a little bit about the importance of writing scripts to do videos from, because I think people who watch videos might just assume, oh yeah, you know, Lee just flips on the camera and he just starts doing stuff. Like, it doesn't work that way. Talk a little bit about your use of scripting and how important that is to the work you guys do.
It's at the very heart of it. I sometimes say that if you really boil down what we do, we're writers more than we are anything else. Like, that's really where the communication and the strategy lives, is in the script. And so every video starts with an idea, and then research and some, you know, note taking around what are the big ideas that need to come out of this, and we try to, you know, make sure they're accurate and things like that. And then the wheels start to turn in terms of how do we make this a story? Is there an analogy here? Can we, you know, one of the things that we try to do is take something and abstract it out of real life and place it into a fictional place that strips out all the baggage and helps you focus just on the main idea. And that takes time. And sometimes it takes a lot of revisions, but we write scripts using Google Docs, and Sachi is our editor. We are a team, and we're very different in our approach to most things. I'm more creative and my mind is more open to lots of different perspectives, where she is more analytical and more detail oriented and can pick out things that I don't see and really has a really big impact on everything we do. But I write the first version of the script, and then it's iterative from there. And one of the things I was just thinking about that work is that, you know, we've been doing this together since 2007. And it wasn't always easy to, you know, work with someone from home with your wife 24/7, you know, we're together all the time, and have a relationship that's built on a business, well, have a business relationship that really has this critical aspect to it, where, you know, our success depends on our ability to criticize one another's work.
Yeah.
And we've come to terms with that, but it wasn't always easy. I often felt like that my bubble was getting burst, or that I wasn't being listened to. But we've reached a point now where, you know, she'll take a look at a script and be like, need to start over. That doesn't work. Like, you know, you just need to go back and do it again. And I think that's true with most of the things we do. I've just come to the realization that the best work that I can do often comes from trying multiple times, that the first time is very rarely what is actually going to be the best product for us.
Mm-hmm. And even if you did a first draft, I mean, you talk about iteration, right? There might be 5-6 cycles through which you go through. And Sachi is like really challenge you and pushing you to make it the best, right? So when you get to the end of it, it's not really your first try. It's a first try with, you know, 8 revisions to make it completely different than where you started from, right? So that's sort of the beauty of that.
Yeah, for sure. And that's before we even get to visuals in the script. You know, I will make one example about that idea of abstraction is two videos ago was about disinformation, which I think is a very relevant topic right now.
Yeah.
And there's a lot we could have said about the political environment that people are seeing right now. But instead of talking about that and using real world examples, we told a story of two towns that were separated by a river and them having a debate about whether they should build a bridge over the river or not. And that was a way for us to show how one town used disinformation to influence the other town. And that's my favorite kind of sort of explainer work, is finding some perspective that is new and not, doesn't have all the baggage of the real world subject. And sometimes that just takes time. I really enjoy thinking creatively about that.
I think that's one of the powers of story, right? You can tell stories that speak to current relevant events, but say them in a neutral enough way that it might be that might be the opening to help someone think differently about something they've been a staunch, you know, they've been one way, in the story reveals to them a different way. I think, I don't know why this pops in my head, but I think of King David in the Bible. Like, he commits adultery, and there's a prophet that comes to him and tells him a story about this evil guy who's like stealing sheep, and like, it's totally allegorical, right? But it's about him.
That's what I was gonna say.
And he gets really angry at where is this thief, and they, you know, then of course the guts of the prophet that says, David, you're the man, right? Then suddenly he's like faced with like this, oh boy, now what do I do, right? So he sort of got him, right? He got him to understand the concept, but all the specifics were taken out of it. So it really went, again, you're coming back to principles. What's the principles? Not so much the tactics, right? It comes back to that. That's pretty interesting. So let's say you get the script where you really like it. Now, when you make that shift, like, how does it turn into the, you know, the videos that we see, the graphics? Like, is there lots of iteration in that, or is your style pretty well locked down that you kind of know how you're going to approach things? Does the script cover 80% of it?
Yeah, You know, I'll tell you about the process first. Okay. So from the beginning, we've always used very simple common tools. We use presentation software for putting together storyboards. So my first step is to go through the script and copy out each line of the script that represents a scene. And then I use that as the title of a slide in PowerPoint or Keynote. And then, so then if you do that for the whole script, then you have a presentation essentially with the script for each scene on each slide. And so that sort of isolates those scenes. If we're telling a story, you know, there's common characters that go throughout. So that's something I'm thinking about at the time. But what I do first is before I draw anything that's going to be in the actual video is I print that presentation with 4 to 6 slides on a piece of paper. And then I just use a pencil and sketch out ideas for each of those scenes that might be a little diagram of how something moves around on the screen, or it might be a conversation, or it might be smiles or frowns or whatever it is that's happening in the scene. And sometimes I'll walk through that with Saatchi to kind of get a feel for how the story would flow visually and connect to the script. And we brainstorm how that could be better. And what that sketch does, we call that a thumbnail sketch. And what that does is allows, once we get a good feeling for that, and that might happen 2 or 3 times, that allows it to be a place for us to say, okay, let's make a list of all the visuals we need for this. So we need this figure doing these things. We need a house, we need a building, we need a car, we need a whatever else. And one of the things that's been really helpful over a long time doing this for so long is every time you make a video, we create visuals that become a part of our library of visuals. So we don't need to make 500 computers, for instance. We have a few computers that we use and they're fine. Like, you know, the video value of the video doesn't relate to how, you know, unique the computer is in that video. So some of the things we pull right from our library, some of them we create from scratch. And I do that work with a Wacom tablet and SketchNote, you know, what is now a free tool from Autodesk. I believe it's SketchNote. I don't even notice what I'm using sometimes, but
you just use it for so long, yeah, you've forgotten what it's called.
Yeah, it's Sketchbook. I will draw the figures and draw the characters and that sort of thing. And then I actually developed a process years ago where I draw the figures and then I indicate colors with swatches. And then I actually ship those off to my friend in Sri Lanka who vectorizes them. So he can very quickly and very nicely turn them into very clean images and then give them back to me in different forms. So I get them back as PNGs and EPS and things like that, that we can then add to our library. And we have these nice, much cleaner versions of the images that I, you know, based on my images, basically. And so the early version of the storyboard goes through my hand-done sketches and then my digital sketches unvectorized. And then I switch those out for the vectorized images that look nice and clean.
And then you can size them and mess with them, and they hold their quality if they're vectorized.
Yeah, definitely. And it makes it really easy to put something in Sketchbook and say, like, a lot of our visuals are very similar. For folks that go look at them, you'll notice that they all have a very similar style that's very low noise. There's people don't have hair or really fingers and things like that. Super simple. But sometimes we need to match colors and things, and just throwing a PNG into Sketchbook, I can use the fill tool to change their clothes to any color I want. And it means that one character might go across multiple videos with different colors, and interesting, you know, it works.
Interesting. That follows the idea that I talk about in the SketchNote handbook around building a visual library, right? Similar concept where you start building these images that you repeat, and then you develop sort of a style around it. And it sounds like you've taken it a step further to actually build a literal vector library that you can then you yourself can pull from, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, some people become members of CommonCraft to access our library. We call them cutouts. They came from us cutting out pieces of paper for our videos early on. But yeah, we that's a version of Common Craft membership, but I always say that I'm probably the number one user of the Cutout Library.
That's kind of cool, because if you think about it, if you subscribe to it, you're always making videos. So the value of that, of the cutouts, is increasing every time you do a video, right? Because you're adding to it.
Yeah, it's a byproduct. Like, we're making those anyway. So that's been a fortuitous thing for us in terms of the business, for sure.
Well, that's really cool. And so you've got two books I want to mention. I think, talk about the first one, and then the second one talks more about like your business and how you approach business, mm-hmm. which I'm really fascinated by. Actually, fascinated by both, but I'd love to hear, have you share about both of them for people who don't know about these two books.
Yeah. The first book came out in 2012, and it's called The Art of Explanation, Making Your Ideas, Products, and Services Easy to Understand. And it's a book that it really is about the skill of explanation, and encouraging people to see that explanation is a skill that you can develop and hone, and that can become a competitive advantage. What's in the book is really based on us being professional explainers starting in 2007 and thinking and working a lot in the field of explanation, which we feel is kind of new and not something that people think about as a skill, much less a profession. So the book was our look at, you know, how we approach this new concept and how we make things easy to understand. It's not necessarily about making videos. It's really for any professional that wants to communicate with clarity. But the lessons come from our video work. And it's structured in a three-part plan, package, present kind of style, where with explanation, a lot of it goes into being very intentional about your communication and taking a step back and thinking about your audience's needs and thinking about, you know, the curse of knowledge and the language you're using, and that planning part of it, I think, is something that people often neglect. So again, yeah, that came out in 2012. It's still available in ebook and audiobook and things like that.
And that, I think, could be really valuable for a sketchnoter on a bunch of levels. One, just thinking about how you structure and present your sketchnote, if it's for trying to share an idea that communicates to someone. And then I know there's lots of sketchnoters now that are moving into sharing their work as like in teaching, right? So it goes back to providing information in a way that someone can understand, because really you're explaining either your techniques or you're, you know, maybe you're doing video of the graphic recording or sketchnoting you're doing for a client, right? So all those things there's value in all those things.
Yeah, definitely. I think that there is something really unique about the sketchnote side of that, where, you know, you're seeing someone's creativity oftentimes in real time, or at least being captured in real time. And it's an idea that's sort of emerging and evolving. And I think that's such a cool thing for people to see, because I think their mind is kind of like following the process as it's being drawn and things are being revealed. And video, I think, is a great way to do that too.
Yeah. I think probably the last thought on that was, I find that I do my best work when I and prepared. So what looks like me being very in the moment is that, but it only works because maybe I've already drawn the title. I've decided what the layout will be. I've limited my tools to these three, a black and a color and something else, right? And I know what the size of the page, like I take away all the things that could be variables and I make them locked down so that I can totally focus on the content and how I'm going to lay things out. And you could probably even push this further, like I'm going to use these letter forms, right?
Yeah, that's a really big part of what we learned in doing Common Craft videos. We started from very basic perspective. We had started with whatever we had on hand, so paper cutouts and a marker and a cheap camera. But as we started to see that our videos had their own style and their own sort of perspective, we started to see that we were actually operating under a set of constraints and that we could actually recognize that and then apply those constraints to ensure that Common Craft videos continued to have an identifiable style and even brand, visual brand. And an example of that is music, right? A lot of videos are great with music, but we never started with music. It was never even occurred to us to use music. But eventually we realized that, like, yeah, we never have to think about licensing music. We never have to think about, you know, working with a composer or finding the right thing or whatever it is. Like, we just don't have to think about it. And So it was like, okay, well, maybe that's a constraint. Common Craft Videos don't have music. We don't have to think about that. Mm-hmm. And maybe part of that is like, okay, we don't have hair. We don't, you know, our visuals are practically stick figures that, you know, that don't even have to relate to any specific identity. It's mm-hmm. just like, you know, it's that simple. And I'm a big believer, and this is true with business and creative things, that constraints are actually liberating, mm-hmm. that they actually reveal worlds to you that you might not otherwise see.
Right. I think you're totally on track with the way I think about things. And it, you mentioned business. So let's talk about the second book, which is about business. And yeah, I think the title is Big Enough. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. Big Enough. And it's building a business that scales with your lifestyle. And, you know, since we were talking about constraints, I think that is an interesting starting point for the book. You know, we were very fortunate in 2007 to get attention from our work, and we started getting hired by a lot of companies to make videos that explain their products and services. Our second client was Google, and we made a video called Google Docs in Plain English, which you can still find on YouTube. Mm. And in 2008, we've been doing that work for a while. And it was, you know, we were doing, you know, pretty well financially, but we were burned out, and we had to figure out, you know, what we wanted to be when we grew up. Like, what was Common Craft going to become? And in 2008, about a year after we started making the videos, we agreed to operate under a set of constraints that we saw as a way for us to protect our quality of life. Mm-hmm. You know, we're entrepreneurial, business-oriented people, and we have lots of friends who have done all kinds of things in business. And we see how a successful business doesn't lead to happiness very much. you might make a lot of money, but it also has a negative effect in a lot of ways. And we didn't want that to happen to us, because we're a married couple working from home. If mm-hmm. if the business doesn't go where we want it to, or it doesn't support our values, then it could be a problem for us personally as well mm-hmm. as professionally. And at that point, why are we doing it? Why would we, you know, risk that? So we said that we're not going to have employees. Like, no matter what opportunities come our way, we're never going to hire employees. We're always going to be home-based. We're not going to take on investors or try to grow into a big office or a creative agency. That we're going to be intentionally small. And that was in 2008 that we made that decision. And, you know, it's 2020 now, and we're still operating under those constraints. And we went through a lot of experiments in trying to figure out how to build Common Craft into the business that we wanted in that time. Hmm. And Big Enough is about those experiments, and it's about our sort of perspective and philosophy and business. And I think the bigger message and the what I hope that people get from it is that I think it's time to think about business in a different perspective and what success really looks like. Like, I don't think that success necessarily has to be who has the biggest pile of money. Mm-hmm. I think that there's different ways of looking at success that has to do with quality of life and health and, you know, mental health and sanity and things that I think really matter. And I hope that the book can be a way for people to see that they are actually wealthy in things that matter, and maybe see how those things might influence their professional lives or their lives as entrepreneurs.
Hmm. That sounds really excellent book. I've got it. I think didn't it release pretty recently? I seem to remember there was like a pre-order.
Yeah, it was about a month ago.
And that's so we're recording in mid to late October. So.
Yep,
so it's been out for a little bit, so I think it's definitely worth. I'm gonna pick up a copy and check it out, and I think it's really in sync with where I'm at with this work I'm doing. And I think there's lots of sketchnoters who are doing sketchnoting work on as a contract thing, either full time or as a side thing, mm-hmm. Doing mm-hmm. illustration work. Right, often doing this work leads to other opportunities. I keep hearing that from guests on the show and people I talk with. So going into a situation where it could, like, you know, I've been in that place on my own when I've written my own books, where writing the book really, I had a full-time job and then writing the book dominated my evenings. Now, I could accept that because I knew it would end, right? There was a deadline, it would be over with, and I would recover, right? But, like, I could see where if it got successful enough, you could be tricked into continuing that kind of a pace and not being able to sustain it. And I see even now, like after a hard day at work, even a good day at work, I get to the end of the day and I might have some stuff I wish I could do at night, but I'd rather sit and watch a dumb TV show with my wife or play with my kids, or like, you know, that's a decision I'm making. And, you know, if you feel like you can't, you don't have that choice, like you have to do this work, like that's not a good place to be, really not. And
it's really, it's really true. I'm the same way. I mean, we work all day, and then like I really look forward to just not having to think about things, not having to do things. And I think that we have lived in a culture for generations where productivity felt like an obligation. And I think that the pandemic has changed people's perspective on time and their personal time and the value of their personal time, because it's shaken up everything, you know, from work to home to family life. And, you know, I personally, I've been really, a lot of Big Enough is about the idea of time and having control of your time and finding ways to think about that. And I'm a big fan of, you know, making decisions that optimize time over other things. I say in the book that I believe time is the new wealth, that people in the future will strive and make decisions based on what will give them more time, you know, versus more money. And money is important. Everybody, you know, wants money. I would love more money. That's not my message. My message is that time has its own kind of currency. But the problem is that it slips through your fingers every day. You can't pile it up. Like you just have to design it into your life. And that takes some effort and some intention.
Well, these sound both like really excellent books for anyone listening. We'll of course have those in the show notes, so you can check them out and go check those out for sure.
Yeah, you can find really quick. I can't help it. I'm in book promotion mode. So forgive me, but bigenough.life is the URL for the book.
Great. And we'll make sure to link those up for you guys. So I'm going to shift a little bit to favorite tools. Now, I know you work in a slightly different place. You've sort of hinted at a couple of tools that you use. And since you're in a little bit different place than maybe an Illustrator or SketchNote or something, but you're still a visual thinker, I say, I would love to hear whatever tools you think are interesting to you that could be attractive for someone listening. Maybe they might be really good because they are sick of hearing about pens and notebooks and stuff. I don't know.
Sure. You know, I have a probably what is an odd perspective on this. I mentioned before that we use simple tools. This is true with a lot of things, that I think that tools sometimes get in the way. I think that they can sometimes become a crutch, that, you know, that having the best tool or the most expensive or the most feature rich tool is the only way to do it. And for me personally, they sometimes get in the way. So I actually use PowerPoint and Keynote for a lot of things. And if I need to just quickly visualize something, like we're in the process of building a house right now. So I'm working with the architect who actually does the real drawings, the sort of blueprint kind of drawings. But if I need to quickly put together what I think a shelf should look like, like I can't imagine anything faster except for maybe drawing on a piece of paper, putting together a quick drawing and using PowerPoint shapes. So this is not going to inspire that many people maybe on the podcast, but it's very real to me. And I've done it for years. So it's just so easy for me at this point. So that's even true with some common craft drawings. I can throw together a house in PowerPoint very quickly, or enough for a common craft drawing. But I do use a Wacom Cintiq tablet that's right here beside me right now. And it's been around for years. I don't really have a lot of needs for anything more, but I do. Once I switched to drawing directly on a tablet, that really upped my game, I think, being able to do that. Yeah. And I use, like I said, I use Sketchbook by Autodesk, which I believe is free now for anyone. And for our needs, which are actually quite simple, you know, like I said, our visuals are simple. They're practically, you know, stick figures in some ways. I don't need to do a lot of fancy things. So that's really kind of my setup for that. I use a Mac computer. In fact, right now I'm just using a laptop. I don't have like a big screen setup like a lot of creative people do. I'm using a Blue Yeti mic right now. That's what I use for the voiceovers. And it's a really small setup. I've come to, you know, like it being mobile. You know, I can work from anywhere using this setup.
I think the advantage of having simple setups, so like in a, I would say related to that, like I've been a big believer in using gel pens I can get at Walgreens, because inevitably my gel pen is going to run out and I'm going to need one, and I don't want to have to like wait 2 weeks for it to come from some special place. And so using standard pens I mean, the quality are so good. And then probably the other relatable thing was when I first did workshops in person, I gave away fancy Moleskine notebooks with stickers on them. But what I observed was people were afraid to use them because they were too pretty at that point in their development, right? They were just starting. Like, you can't give them, like, we're going to teach you how to drive and you're going to drive a Ferrari, right? Like, now you're worried about scratching it. So one of my lessons was in the in-person workshops was I just bring a ream of paper and a box of flare pens. It's so simple.
Yeah, totally.
It's very approachable. If you mess it up, you just crumple the paper away and you don't feel bad. Like the flare pens bring you back to junior high school in some cases, or, you know, they're just really hard to beat, right? So like there's some beauty, I think, in a simple setup because, like you said, it's portable and then it's reliable, right? You know what you're going to get from it, and you're not like, the more fiddly you get your systems, like there's just a more chance, more opportunities for that to go sideways at the wrong times, you know? So there's definitely benefits.
I totally agree. I've been actually working on doing more handwriting and hand drawing things. I live, you know, our work is all digital. So like I will do a lot on the computer, but through Big Enough, we did a pre-order campaign and I sent out stickers for people that had pre-ordered, and I sent them a nice note that was often, you know, multiple sentences and very personal. And I had not handwritten things in a long time. And the first few notes I just threw away because you could hardly read them. And I really thought like something that would benefit me is actually trying to be a good handwriter. Like it would, I almost think it like meditation or like something almost like Buddhism. It's like, why am I rushing through this? Why do I feel like I can't write out ING? Then I just do a line with a squiggle at the end. Like, I feel like it would be good for me to try to just focus and go slowly and make it as nice as possible. And by the time I had written, you know, 65 or 70 of them, it had improved a lot. And I felt more comfortable with it. And I was like, I need to do this more. I mean, first of all, I would love to send more thank you notes for whatever reason. I think that's a great thing to do. But also handwriting them really, I think, is a nice touch too.
Yeah, it's so unusual now. It's so too easy to write a text or an email. So when you get a handwritten letter, it's suddenly like, wow, this somebody wrote this by hand. This wasn't a telemarketer, you know, with a machine in a back room that's like making it look like handwriting, right? So real handwriting. So that's, and it is meditative, right? And I think the other thing is seeing the improvement by the time you hit 65, that just verifies this idea that repetition and practice does improve, right? It's such a forgotten thing, but, and it's easy and hard, right? It's easy because you just keep doing it and you're going to improve if you put your mind to it. The hard part is you got to suck it up and stick through the 65 to see the results, right? So
it's true. It's true. And my hands, part of it is mechanical too. Like my hand was just not used to being in that position. It's like playing a guitar. Like in the start, it's like painful and like my fingers have to do this thing. What the hell? And then and then over time you get calluses and you get your fingers stretched out and, you know, not that I'm a guitar player, but I've tried, I know what it's like to try.
Interesting. Well, that's, that leads me to, questions about tips. So we normally have three tips. Typically they talk about, you know, visual thinking, sketchnoting. I think in this instance, we thought that it might be fun to do, three tips for better communication or explanations. I'll leave it open for you to interpret that.
Yeah.
Things that you would recommend somebody who's really got their interest piqued, they're interested in the books and the common craft and this approach of explaining and how it can improve their sketchnote work or their visual thinking work. So give us three tips that you would recommend.
Yeah, sure. You know, one of them is something that Elon Musk has been quoted saying a couple of times about learning is to think about learning as a semantic tree, and that the leaves on the end of the tree are like the details and how you do things and the specifications, but those don't make sense unless you can actually get to the trunk. And you really have to focus on the trunk of the learning before the leaves are really going to make sense, like are really going to be useful. So I think that analogy is a way to think about explaining things and how to understand and even learn things is, are you looking at the leaves, branches, or the trunk of the idea? And to make sure you spend some time explaining or learning about the trunk, because it makes everything else so much more relevant. So that's one thing. I think that in our experience in making videos, that if you are struggling to explain something to you're struggling to learn something or explain it to someone else, that writing out an explanation is an amazing way to start to understand it and see how your mind is thinking about it. There's mm-hmm. something called the Feynman method, which comes from Richard Feynman, mm-hmm. the famous physicist. And the idea was that if he was a professor, so if you're teaching something and seeing that, you know, your ability to make it understandable comes from being able to write it out. And once you reach a point where you're not sure how to explain it, it means you don't understand it well enough. And you have to mm-hmm. go back to the materials and learn, maybe it's that trunk idea, mm-hmm. And then bring that back into the teaching to make it better. So writing your ideas down and pretend you're writing a letter. Hey Mike, I'm going to write and explain to you how, you know, blah, blah, blah works. Mm-hmm. And that intention really matters. And then the third point I would say is realize that explanation is sort of like comedy, that just because it's funny to you, like, let me take a step back and say, it's like comedy in that very rarely is it objectively funny. It's subjective, and it depends mm-hmm. on the audience's perception, and every audience is different. So there's very few explanations that apply universally, that your success as an explainer and a communicator is related to understanding your audience, mm. their needs, what language they use, and what examples are going to make sense to them.
Mm. That's a good thing to remember too, especially sketchnoting is somewhat international with people in Europe and here in America and also in Asia. So there can be, I've seen that with translations of my book where metaphors I've used as an American do not work at all for a Chinese yeah. audience and had to be retranslated. Now, the core of it's the same, but the way it was told in the metaphor had to be changed. So that's a good yeah, thing to bear in mind.
For sure. I mean, that fits right. Like, you know, comedy doesn't travel well, mm-hmm. you know, like that there are so much nuance and, like you're saying, metaphors and things that our comedy depends on that makes it hard.
Hmm. Those are really three great tips for those listening. And it's been really fun to have you on. How can people reach you? I think you mentioned the book, but there are probably a variety of other places. Are you active in certain social medias or websites that are good to go to?
Yeah. You know, I usually post on Twitter every day. Mm-hmm. I don't talk about politics if that matters to people. There might be the occasional thing, but sure. I try to not be about that. Yeah. So the home of my writing and my sort of personal side is leelafever.com. And that's okay. where my books and my blog is. Commoncraft.com is my website. That's where we have Commoncraft membership with videos and cutouts. Mm-hmm. And I say sometimes that I'm a fortunate person that I don't have competition for my name on social media. So you can find me at LeelaFever, at LeelaFever at most of the platforms. But Twitter and Instagram are probably my biggest.
Okay, gotcha. That's really great. Thanks for making time. This is it's kind of a fun, refreshing, different topic for this podcast. And, you know, listeners will know that I try to push and reach out to things that are adjacent and similar, and that we can mm-hmm. we can always learn from other areas how we can do things better. So thanks for making time to be on the show, Lee. This has been really fun.
Yeah, it's really great to reconnect with you, Mike.
Well, and for those of you listening, this is going to be a wrap for another episode of the Sketchnote Army podcast. Until the next episode, we'll talk to you soon. The Sketchnote Army podcast was created by me, Mike Rohde, and brought to you by Rohde Design Studios. It's produced and edited by Alec Polianis of Amp Creative Studios. The theme music was created by John Schiedemeyer. To support the creation of this show, I invite you to buy one of my books, the Sketchnote Handbook or the Sketchnote Workbook. You can find the books on Amazon or go to peachpit.com and use the code RODY40 for 40% off. Please share this podcast with other visual thinking friends, and be sure to leave a nice rating on iTunes or your favorite podcast listening app so others can find the show.